listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your host, Craig Bisgaia and Tim Harrison. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
This Model Railcast Show was recorded on February 19th of 2015. All right, Model Railcasters, we've got the long-awaited show 206, and I've got Craig Bisgaia with me. Craig, how's it going?
I'm good. Thanks. Doing good. Good. All right.
And Bob Sprague is back with us. Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you again.
Great, great. So we're kind of relaunching this series here, but, you know, as Craig mentioned on the pre-show, we really do need to take just a few minutes here, as all of you should by now know, or most of you, I'm sure, do, that unfortunately, Ryan Anderson, who we learned in show 200, had stage 4 lung cancer, did pass away. Guess what? It's been now two and a half weeks.
And it's still a shock.
It really is. It really is. He's a young guy. He's our age. You know, he leaves behind Noah and Sherry, his wife, who is a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right.
Yeah. Now, Craig, you got to meet Ryan early on in the Model Railcast show, and he was only in the show 30s at that point.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was show 39, in fact, was the first one that I actually was a part of. And they asked me to come on and talk about the Ten Commandments of the Model Railroading, which we haven't talked about here in ages.
That's right.
We ought to do that again sometime. But really enjoyed the appearance. I was nervous as heck. And, one appearance turned into another, and I built up a relationship with Ryan and with you guys and all. And eventually I guess I was more trouble to try to shoo away than.
I think what it was is we invoked a little known, seldom used reserve activation clause.
That's it. Something along those lines. Right. So, Ryan was all happy to, you know, have me along as well for the ride. And, certainly since around show, 37, 38 or so, or maybe farther, maybe around 50. I think I've kind of been a part of most of them at this point. So it's great to have been part of it for as long as we have.
Yeah.
But it's important to remember that, you know, this was Ryan's thing from the very beginning when it was just him and Will.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you came on and,
Jay Smith. Yep.
Jay Smith. Right. You know, and you guys, held the fort down for quite a while. And, unfortunately we've lost Will some time ago. But I came on and we've had 200 and something shows now.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately of which, you know, Ryan was only a part of until about 100, 120 or so, maybe a little farther along. But the show's been going for about 10 years?
Yeah. He started a good juggernaut here.
He really did. And, you know, it's been an honor to have been a part of it and to have known Ryan for all that time. And, you know, I didn't have all that much contact with him over the last couple of years. You actually had far more than I did, being that you guys were talking a lot about getting shows uploaded and all like that. But it was always great when he came on to talk to him. And in the last couple of months, when we found out Ryan was so ill and up to the point where he did pass away, we've actually had so many people contact us and come to shows that we've been at, for instance, at the big Springfield show that happened a couple of weeks ago, and did Timonium shows here in the East. People have come up and talked to me and said, you know, how much Ryan really, you know, got to them and really made them feel very much a part of the hobby. How he was very eager to ask the questions sometimes that other people might be too embarrassed to ask.
He was fantastic at that.
He really was. And that was something that, you know, we just keep hearing over and over again. And so many people appreciated him for the fact that he was willing, you know, to do that. And he didn't know everything and it was okay, you know, but he wasn't afraid to ask questions that sometimes might have seemed silly. But, you know, more often than not, we got feedback from folks saying, I'm glad you asked because that was something I wanted to know. And, you know, I don't know if that would have gotten answered if you hadn't.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know for me, it was right around show 20 or so. Well, actually, it was show, the Sweet 16 show was coming up, and so I wanted to do something special for that, and so I sent in a drawing, a pen and ink drawing of two different locomotives. And then after that, I sent in a branch line piece on the Baldwin Shark Nose, I think, and then Ryan was like, hey, my voice is kind of froggy this weekend, you mind coming on? And so that's kind of how he hooked me, and I still remember one of the first things he said to me when we finally got to do a show together was he asked me how many kids I had, and at that time I think I only had four. Mm-hmm. And his line was, "Well, you know how that happens, right?" And I was like, "Yes, I do."
I'd say that you were intimately involved.
So, but yeah, you know, he was a fun guy, and like you said, Craig, everybody often just say he asked the questions that people were afraid to ask and wanted to know.
And also, you know, a lot of things that with Ryan was just that not only was he not afraid to do those things, but he was awfully infectious. He could, you know, very good at, you know, just making people feel at ease. I know he did with me many times early on. And then, you know, really anybody would come on. He was an expert really at running the show, at making sure that good questions got asked, that the things kept moving along. You know, he was really very good at, and you are too, as we all know. I'm terrible at it, but that's why I'm the color commentary and you're the guy running everything, which is just fine, really. You know, Ryan was really one of those great people who just really had a real passion for podcasting and also for the hobby.
Yeah.
And the two things turned out to be a great combination for us. And we're really going to miss him, Zola. Yeah. I can really say, you know, it is just such a shame that, you know, this happened, and he will greatly be missed.
Yeah, he will. And I've said it on the Facebook page, and I'll say it again. The outreach, Sherry contacted me in the email, and she said that she knew Ryan. Lots of people knew Ryan, but even she didn't have any idea as to the impact to the model railroading world that he really had. And she was just blown away to see all the response, not only just on the Model Railcast page, but people from all the railroad podcasting pages were reacting to it. And she was
so
blown away from that in the best possible way.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. And Bob, now do you have any memories of Ryan, or did you come on after he had largely finished his podcasting, the broadcasting bit of it?
No, I never had the chance to meet him, and certainly heard some of the shows later on where he appeared, but I did not have a lot of familiarity. But if I can speak on behalf of your listeners for a moment to just thank him for getting this thing started, and for you guys for keeping it going, because I think it's become such a key way for folks in the hobby to communicate and share. So his spirit lives on, I think, in what you're doing, and we all appreciate what he started and what you all continue to do for us.
Well, thank you, Bob. That really means a lot.
That's what we want to do, right, Craig?
Absolutely. Yeah. We want to reach people. We want to entertain people. We want to, you know, teach people. Yeah. And those are things that Ryan also was really interested in. So if we can keep that going, then, you know, hopefully we're doing right by him.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what I'd really like to have as a legacy.
Well, he might qualify as a visionary, because I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but podcasting is hip again. It was sort of
what? Really?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know if there's anybody in the world who hasn't heard the Serial podcast yet, but are you guys familiar with that?
Sounds familiar, but I'm not sure if I have.
Actually. Well, it's interesting to a guy in my business, because you know how everybody has such a short attention span these days, and you know we're getting down to 6-second videos and things like that. Well, Serial is one story told over 12 segments of an hour each, so it's 12 hours of listening. And the first season now qualifies as the most downloaded podcast in the history of podcasting. So it's coming back, and you guys were there, you know, when it wasn't cool. So
yeah, no, that's true, actually. And you're right. In a lot of ways, Ryan really was. This was an idea that I think a lot of people had talked about doing. And I don't know if Ryan was the first. I think that Scotty Mason says that he may have been the first one. But if he wasn't the first, then Ryan was right up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that when he was doing it, you know, he had Will on as the resident expert, and he was just, you know, trying to, you know, he was new to the hobby and really excited about it and just trying to figure out, you know, what to do and having different people on and talking to him about this and that. I mean, if I remember, he used to ask a lot of personal questions about his own railroad and, right. you know, what should I do with this? Right. What should I do with that? And that's really how it all started,
yeah.
you know, and I think that that was such a cool thing about the way it began.
Yeah, you're right. He was looking for answers about his railroad, and he did mention that Scotty's show was his inspiration. But what Ryan did that was revolutionary is that the format of the podcast itself was revolutionary, and that the Model Railcast show was in what we call a magazine format. You know what I mean? There were certain sections, and not that Scotty didn't have sections, but it was more free flowing and. Not necessarily as it was topical, but Ryan would have a very, very, okay, here's the RPO. We're going to, you know, discuss things that are fan centered. Okay. Here is the coaling tower where we're going to review, you know, whatever the latest product is. Here's the roundhouse where we have the beefy talk, but so basically, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Model Railcast show gained the audience that it did was because it was, you know, scratching an itch, so to speak.
Absolutely. The other thing I think, too, is that when Scotty began, I mean, let's not forget that in the beginning, a lot of his show was really all about Craftsman structures.
Sure.
Which was really,
yeah,
I mean, that's Scotty's wheelhouse right there.
Yeah.
You know, and by all means, you know, they did a very good job covering what was going on with that and all. But Ryan really ended up starting was really something that's much more of a, like, say, People magazine as opposed to the Smithsonian. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, we've gone, you know, very, not to say that we're like running with the popular thing, but we're very eclectic. We've had all different kinds of discussions from prototype stuff to all different aspects of modeling. And pretty much if it's out there and of some marginal interest to the hobby, we've in a lot of cases, we've been there. We've talked about it. You know? So we really have a very wide ranging you know, reach in terms of the topics that a lot of other shows, I think Model Rail Radio probably comes in close. They have an awful lot of people in, and I love the way that they have that egalitarian thing going on where they have so many people who get involved with it.
Oh, I tell you what, too, it's great, man, for when I'm on those long treks, you know, nothing beats, you know.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, absolutely. And as we kind of turn from, you know, obviously we're acknowledging Ryan Anderson's passing, but also, you know, Bob, you were so smart in bringing up his legacy, and I know, you know, I've heard, guys, you need to listen to Scotty Mason's most recent show. Let me just say that, because what a wonderful...
Yeah, it was a nice tribute.
It really was. Those guys were so sweet. It was so great. And even Tom Barbalay, although I don't know if Model Rail Radio had a chance to react to that. No, I know they haven't. Probably in the show they just recorded, they were able to acknowledge that. But Tom has often even said how inspirational Ryan Anderson was in the way, you know, in Tom Barbalay wanting to make a Model Railroad podcast. And so his legacy is definitely confirmed. You know, I still have Philippa Ballantyne. Whenever I have her do the new intros for the show, I always have her say Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast show, and I'm probably always going to continue that.
That's a great thing. We should definitely do that.
Yeah, awesome. Let's talk about some updates. Craig, I am dying to know, have you been able to get anything done on the Housatonic?
Well, a little bit here and there. I haven't been concentrating a lot on getting the railroad ready to run lately. If everybody was listening for a while, they probably would probably remember that back in, I guess at this point, it was 2013, around April or May, I had a big operating session. And as some people may recall, there were some issues before that where the railroad, you know, basically blew up and had to get a number of stuff fixed on a very short amount of time. And it was a great experience, but I kind of got burned out of it after that. And,
yeah, I could get that. I can understand.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, for a long time, I didn't work on the railroad at all. probably about 9 months. And then beginning of 2014, I started getting more interested in doing stuff. But even with that, I haven't really worked on the railroad so much as I've just been doing a lot more work on model building, which is really my passion. That's the thing that I love the most about the hobby. And, you know, I kind of figured at that point that if I was really going to start getting back into things, I had to go and work to my strength. And you know, that's kind of what I've been working on. In that time, we've brought out from Amesville Shops, which some of you may know is the very, very tiny company that I run that makes early period freight cars. And back in, I guess it was April of last year, we brought out the Pennsylvania Railroad XC boxcar kit, which was a laser cut wood kit in major scale. That sold very nicely. I think I sold probably about 70 units of that, which was great. And then I spent the fall this year getting together an old project that I had done for another early period Pennsylvania Railroad car, a GA gondola, which was about a 36, 37 foot long gondola car with low wood sides. And what was interesting about it is it has a dump bottom, which is basically a couple of trap doors in the center of the car where they could, if they were carrying coal or gravel, they could open those and then push the coal or whatever aggregate towards the middle of the car and eventually have it dump out. Up until that point, really the only way to do it was send a bunch of guys with shovels and have them push it all over the side. This was well before the real advent of hopper cars, which are basically designated as like a self-clearing type of car with slanted sheets in the bottom that when you open the hatches, it basically clears the entire car out at once without having to have anybody go in and do anything. But this was a very common way in the 1880s to still move coal, and that's what these cars were actually used for. But anyway, getting off topic. But I finally have that out, and I'm literally putting together the last bits, including the instructions for that kit, which has just been released, and hoping that I sold so far about 40 of them, which is great. I'd like to sell some more if I can. But it's turning out to be a really fun kit. I think people are really going to like it. And I have plans for some more coming up. But again, that's part of what I've been doing. And the other part is just been doing a lot of stuff with scratch building cars. A couple of people who have been to RPM meets recently have seen some of the stuff I've done, including a pinch gas car that I modeled from a single photograph taken from the back of an observation car, probably about 1914 or so. And it was this little blurb in the bottom left corner that you could barely see, but I blew it up. And I said, I got to have that. So I made that car, and that was a lot of fun. And since then, I've also done a lot of kit bashing, some other cars, making some Union Tank Line freight cars, not tanks, but basically stock cars. They were used a lot for transporting kerosene in barrels. The idea being that when you're transporting the stuff, you either transported it on a flat car or a gondola, or you put it into a car that had ventilation. Because the worst thing that could happen would be to have one leak and have the fumes build up, and then one spark and kaboom, there goes your car, right, along with all the kerosene. So I made a couple of those, had some fun with that, and that's kind of what I've been doing, working on structures, building cars, things like that. Yeah. So that's kind of what's been going on with the Housatonic level.
That's great. Sounds good. And you're enjoying yourself, which is the most important thing.
I am, you know, actually. I've been having a really good time.
That's great here. Now, Bob, do you get to do anything for you, or are you just busy designing stuff for other people?
No, it sometimes feels like that, but I've been making some slow but steady progress downstairs, and you know, it's the kind of thing where I'm not sure anyone else could see it, but I can see it, so it feels good. But I don't know if you guys remember, I'm modeling a Chessy era region in the that's about right about halfway between Washington and Baltimore in the Jessup, Maryland area, and the where there's a little yard that's still there, and an auto unloaded facility and a lot of industrial parks and things like that. And my goal was sort of to get it to the point where I could do some operations and, you know, sort of have it manageable in size and be able to work on different things, because I like lots of different aspects of the hobby, but doing any too much of any one thing in a row can get tedious for anybody.
Sure.
And so, since we talked to you, I think, since I talked to you last, did put in a staging yard, and that allows me to have a fair number of freight cars on the rail, on the rails, so I don't have to be pulling things out of boxes all the time. And I can pull them out and sort them and then deliver them to industries on the area that I've completed so far, which is probably about a fifth of the whole thing that I would like to build eventually, and pick up the empties or loads or whatever and sort them again and send them back into staging. So it's possible to amuse yourself for quite a bit of time. And yet I still am able to work on the scenery in the area where I have completed track as well.
Great. That's great.
Very cool, yeah.
And it's good to hear that you actually can get down in your own basement.
I'm yeah. And my other, and I'll tell you what the mistake I made, though, is I've gotten into designing for 3D printing. And it sort of started because I, you know, needed some parts for these very distinctive warehouses that I am trying to model from the prototype. And there really isn't anything out there for things like sets of stairs and the kind of drain pipes and gutters that they have. And even, you know, it's pretty limited for like rooftop HVAC units and things like that. And so I said, well, what the heck? You know, I have a certain amount of drawing skill. I'll see if I can teach myself SketchUp. And I'll tell you, it's a slippery slope. It's a lot of fun. And you send these things off to Shapeways, and they come back, and you say, wow, that's really cool. And it's a lot more precise than I could ever scratch build or anything. So it's been a lot of fun.
It's going to be great to see what 3D printing does for the hobby overall.
Oh, I'll say. I've got some projects myself lined up that I think will be pretty cool. So, but that's cool to hear you're using it too.
Yeah, that's great. Well, guys, my railroad set dormant, I would say, since my newborn was born.
Funny that, huh?
I know, but I did. I finally
coincidence? We don't think so.
That's what I'm thinking. Although, you can tell when he's finally starting to get a little bit more independent minded because just in the last week or two, I was able to get down, start cleaning up. And basically what I determined, and I kind of knew this was coming, but my yard was a good size one, but it was just not going to be big enough for the railroad. It wasn't going to be big enough to support it. It would store about 50 cars half full, as per Craig Biscard's Ten Commandments of Model Railroading. I'll read.
Thank you very much.
but really, it needs to hold 100 cars half full. So fortunately, Craig, when you were over, you pointed out, you know, those corrections that I could make on the layout. And what I had forgotten was when I originally designed Pavonia Yard, I had designed it sort of staying out of the way of a helix that is no longer going to be there, which means that I can add almost another foot in width to the yard and just sort of reorient the yard a little bit so that I'll be able to easily fit in those 100 cars halfway full. So I was able to gently lift out Biscayer ladder number 2 and Jim Lincoln interlocking and set them aside. And so I will be over the weekend, I'll be going to buy some new lumber to make the additions to the benchwork I need.
Sweet.
So, yep, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, it took a few years, but you finally came around.
Yeah, I know. that's usually the line with me.
yeah, well, you know, it's not unusual, you know? I mean, it happens to me all the time.
What were you going to say, Bob?
I was just wondering, it's sort of like joining a cult, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Very much so, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, man, I was...
We're going to get you sooner or later.
Craig will tell you, man, I was just a tough nut to crack. He's cracked tougher, I'm sure, but I was just like, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then he came down and Jim came down and, oh, I just love it now. Just hand building the turnouts. It's just fun. It's great. So
there you go. Yes, the thing was, he was a hard, tough nut to crack, but we went by the theory of if you let the water drip on the rock, eventually it's going to cut right through that rock.
Yep, yep.
And sure enough, you're now at peace.
That's history.
That's right.
And my wife that influence on people, aren't we? You know,
yes,
we,
you guys are.
I have a new track planning client. Who seems like a real nice guy, and he sent me his requirements in Scalar, and he laid out all his Givens and Druthers in his prototype, which sounded really cool. And then he drops the bomb on me, which is he wanted to use Kato Unitrack for everything.
Oh.
And I'm sure that it's a wonderful product, but it has its limitations in terms of what you can design and what you can't.
Right.
And so I spent a couple of days making templates and playing with it a little bit, and I wrote him back and I said, you sure you want to use Unitrack? You know, it's going to make doing the staging yard kind of tricky, and, you know, I know you're running lots of modern equipment and you want to have a double track main line, and I think I got him. I think I finally got him. So,
as you keep on using that word Unitrack, I do not think it's what you think it is.
You know, and the funny thing is, by Kato's own admission, it's limited. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not even like they're trying, yeah, to say you can do anything with this track.
Three, two, one.
All right, Model Railcasters, as you know, we have Bob Sprague on with us. And, Bob, it is great to have you back on, as we said in the intro. And I'm trying to – with the last time you were on, what the heck were we even talking about? I can't even remember. There's an intro for you.
Yeah, I like that.
What well, yeah, setup. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's not you, Bob. It's me. I promise. No, I think we were – I know one of the things we were talking about was the Hershey layout.
Right.
That you designed for Model Railroader. And since then, I saw a few more of your plans pop up. But, you know, it really begs the question, and it's always really, it's, as I can tell you, you know, I've been model railroading for a while. It really is great to go back to the basics, to come up with a good planning process. Had I done that, I might not have had to tear up Pavonia Yard. You never know. But, Bob, I'm going to start it off with, and really, I love what you have typed there as we're discussing notes. What does a modeler have to do before the planning process can start?
Well, I'll tell you some of the things that I've learned and think are really important. And in case anybody didn't hear the last episode we recorded, I have had the privilege of working with a number of folks to design railroads for them. And so the first thing I think is, and I'm a little anal retentive about this, is to get a really accurate space diagram and to make sure that includes all of the obstructions, all the little barriers and things that can pop out in a basement or another room, because it really can make a big difference on not only what literally will fit, but also what's the best plan for the space. And so when I ask people this before we start, and I'm rarely able to go see the space myself or measure it myself, and I say, I want you to get down there and I want you to measure it within a half an inch or so of, and get the accurate dimensions, and tell me where the windows are, tell me where the doors are, which way they swing, how high the ceiling is, whether there are any protrusions like electrical panels or water heaters or even, you know, little bump outs in the wall where there's a duct or something like that, because in some cases that stuff can get in the way. In some cases it can almost inspire some creativity if you've got a construction you have to work around, and yet, you know, you can go a long way down the track thinking something's going to fit, and then find out, whoops, you know, when I told you it was 20 feet, it's really 19 feet, 2 inches. And, you know, in any scale, that can make a big difference in what's going to fit in the space. And you want to be, I mean, John Armstrong used to say, be creatively pessimistic about what's going to go in there, which is a good way to think about it, because if we're too optimistic and we try to cram things in there, then we usually wind up with situations that where the track work is not reliable and it's no fun to build it and operate it. On the other hand, if you're too pessimistic, you may be really missing out on some opportunities to make your main line longer or fit in more spurs or whatever your goals are for operations. So I always ask folks to really get me a good description of what the space is going to be.
No, that makes sense. Craig, you I'm going to, as you are the owner of what I would term a large layout, because there's large.
It's not small.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's not insanity.
It depends on how you talk. That's go on.
But I mean, this must ring very true with you.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. You have to know the space that you're working in. You have to, you know, have good awareness of, you know, what your physical limitations are, you know, like Bob's saying, you know, it not only width and depth and projections and stuff, but even ceiling height too. Yeah, you know, you have certain things, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that if you're not aware, it's like Santana. If you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it, you know, so you gotta know what's going on or you're gonna make mistakes, you know, and with that you would otherwise not make.
Right.
You know, so that's definitely key. It really is important.
Well, going from there, Bob, what would you follow that up with then? Because, you know, we're dealing with getting the room and making sure that you're getting all the information, or the person is taking into account all the information of the room's features. So what then do you move on to?
Well, the next thing is to set some standards for the railroad. And there are two or three things that really impact the way you design, you know, starting with assuming you know what scale you're in, which is important, obviously. What is the minimum radius that you want, and what is the one that you can live with? And this is largely a function, obviously, of what kind of equipment you really want to run, although it can also be preference in terms of what you want the thing to look like. As most of us know, prototype radius curves, if reproduced in a modeling scale, would pretty much take up your whole house, much less the basement. So we're always dealing with some kind of compromise. But in HO, for example, you know, a lot of equipment will go around an 18-inch curve, but most of it looks awful doing so. And if you've got modern diesels or, you know, cab forwards or something like that from the steam era, you really want to give yourself, you know, 28 inches at a minimum, 30 is better, 36 is great, and if you can go even bigger than that, you're going to be happy. Here again, that's a trade-off between how much you can fit in your space and how big the radius is, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Then another important consideration is the aisle width that you want. I always start, when I can, with 4 feet, because that is a very comfortable space for two people to pass each other without knocking into each other, even if those people aren't particularly trim.
Not that we're pointing any fingers or anything.
No, I wouldn't say that or anything, but that's an important one. And again, it's what do you want and what can you live with? And then the third one is maximum grade, which makes a big difference again on operations, because if you are trying to run big, long, modern trains, and all of a sudden you got a 3.5% grade in the middle of your layout, it's going to be real hard to get them up that hill without some serious helper action or
mm-hmm.
five finger
helper. You
better
have that planned in, you know.
Not that you can't do it, but
you better know what you're doing.
Yeah. And so I'll go from there then to look at what kind of train length you want to have too, and that's an important one, and I'll get I had a gentleman recently say he wanted his minimum train length to be 50 cars in HO, and I said, well, that's really cool, but I hope you realize that that's, you know, 28 feet or so in length, and your basement is only 27 feet long, and, you know, you're not going to be able to fit too much in if that's really what you want in terms of train length, and we compromised on more like 25. So what I've developed is a very simple tool, which I will have on my website by the time this gets out, which allows you to type in the number of cars that you want to have in your minimum train and what scale you're in, and it'll tell you how long that train is going to be with a few locomotives and a caboose on the end, so that you can really get a picture of how long that's going to be. And that affects, you know, you got to think about how long you're main line's going to be, how long your passing sidings are going to be, how long your yard tracks are going to be, how long your staging tracks are going to be, and one of Craig's other dictums, which is that if you don't want to have the beginning of your train in one town and the end of your train in the last town.
Yes.
You've got to have a certain amount of space in between towns. So that can be very important to the planning process going forward.
Yeah, and now thanks for mentioning that tool. That's pretty awesome. Well, when you do add that on, just send me an email with the link so I can put it in the show notes too, so people can check that out. And you know what? It's funny because, yeah, 50 cars would be cool, but I've seen a 25-car train on both the Housatonic, my layout, and even Dave Ramos' layout. 25 cars still looks pretty impressive.
It's pretty impressive, yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think Tony Custer set his layout up for 30, I believe, which is a real nice-looking train.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And so far, I will have to say, I don't have 4-foot aisles, but I did demand 3-foot aisles.
which is very good, and, you know, fat guys around the go, thank you. Yeah. Congratulate you and thank you.
And I think, obviously, you know, that can vary. In fact, it's very common to have narrow choke points can be okay. You can have, if you have 3 feet or 4 foot on one side and then 2 feet or 18 inches in between, and it's for just a short distance,
right?
You can often live with that.
Yeah, I would say that's maybe so. Craig, you've got at least 3 foot aisles on the Housatonic, correct?
Mostly four, a few places where there's some, like there's a lolly column in the middle of the aisle, so it's about 20 inches on either side. I got one spot where it goes down to about 30 inches, but for the most part, yeah, being a decent sized guy and, just also having just a touch of claustrophobia for
right.
me, having wide aisles was really an absolute must. And, it's not something, a decision that I've ever regretted. So.
Right. Right. No, that's great. Well, Bob, after that, you know, I've noticed that you mentioned, and I totally agree here, narrowing in on a theme or a story, which now that's, I love that descriptor because I mean, it really is about telling a story.
You know, I stole that from Doug Gurin recently, who I've had the opportunity to get to know a little bit, and he has a whole way of describing this, which is a lot better than I could do it. But, you know, a lot of us will, after we've been in the hobby for a while, get into a theme where we're saying, okay, it's Southern Pacific in the 50s, or it's Chessy in Jessup, Maryland, or the Housatonic in 1890 or something like that. And that's great. That's better than, you know, just sort of whatever falls onto the railroad. But Doug talks about really having a plot line almost to what's going on. And I can imagine that, you know, just increasing the fun. His plan, of course, is to model the Pennsylvania Railroad at the height of World War II, and his story is sort of patriotism and the railroads helping to win the war. And so in operating on this railroad, his hope would be that people come away feeling like they've helped win the war. And it puts a lot of meaning to, you know, operating in an efficient manner and making sure that you're carrying the right goods to the right places. And I said, that's really neat. That's really another dimension to the way you look at operations. And I think some of the best railroads sort of suggest that kind of almost a plot line to what's going on in addition to just a location and an era.
I can't argue with that. Even on my railroad, one of the things that eventually got me to start really wanting to model the 1890s, which is, you know, kind of an odd thing to want to do, admittedly, had to do with the fact that when I had researched the railroad far back enough to understand what was really happening, the narrative of it was that this was a relatively small regional railroad that was locked in a life and death battle with another larger railroad, the New Haven. And every day they were doing the best that they could to try and keep up and try to keep the doors open in the face of what was basically a behemoth that was determined to destroy them. And that's a very powerful, dramatic narrative. And that was really one of the things that drove me to want to model this railroad and do the operations the way that they were, you know, in order to get that point across to people, like, you know, we're fighting for our lives here.
Right.
You know, so, and that to me, I hope that comes across when people come to operate here. I don't know for sure that it does, but I know for me, when I see what's going on. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as the layout owner, that is incredibly gratifying to right. see that come to life.
And I think it helps you make choices about what you want to emphasize and de-emphasize in your modeling out of the whole range of things you could select. You
sure.
can use that theme to guide, you know, what industries you choose to include and what kind of operations you tend to portray or de-emphasize. And mm-hmm. it sort of gives a sense of purpose that might not otherwise be there.
So after that, you know, we were talking about a theme or a story. So where do we go after that? I mean, I know where I went and it's, but, you know, for me, it was, I knew the theme, well, sort of, you know, the theme was South Jersey was still kind of a boom town in the 50s. You know, there was still some thriving industry. So that was the story I wanted to tell. But, so after you got your theme, you got your story. So where do we go from there?
Well, I think the other thing that's extremely helpful to me is to have, as much prototype info as I can get. And I kind of really, one of the things I really enjoy about track planning is trying to get as close to a prototypical layout as I can. And the best way to do that is to, guess what, look at a prototypical track layout and try to reproduce it in the space that I have. So there are, you know, there are resources out there, some of which are on the web, like one of the ones that's been very handy, because I had a whole theme of doing Reading-based railroads for about six different people, and Conrail had these things called ZTS maps that are most of them are online and have prototype track layouts from all over Conrail territory, and so it's pretty easy to look up a town and see, at least in the Conrail area or era, what was present track-wise in any particular town. And then, of course, the Sanford fire insurance maps.
Oh, you mean Sanborn maps?
Sanborn, you're right. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I
had that wrong.
I heard the Red Fox theme in my head immediately when he said that.
Sanborn.
What are you talking about?
Correct. those are not always terribly precise on the track layout, but they're good for the industries and buildings. And there are a lot of, you know, topographical maps that are out on the web as well. So all that stuff can really give you a good idea of what the real thing looked like. And if you're not modeling a particular prototype, it can make a freelance layout a lot more real if you've been inspired by real track layouts. So I always
That's
appreciate
really
it when people feed that stuff to me and look for it whenever I can. I'm sort of a connoisseur of weird track layouts these days too, and I just did a railroad for a guy who's modeling the CSX Hanover sub, and there's a town called Porter Sidling, and you'd think it was siding, but it's sidling. But it's this really weird Y with two tracks running, and it's still there, and I had to put that on the railroad because it was so weird.
One other thing I was going to say about having to do with the maps and all is, as some people may or may not know, the ZTS maps are a relatively modern thing. They're basically, Conrail only came about in the 1970s. But, of course, there was railroading that went back all the way to the 18th century, or excuse me, the 19th century. And there's a lot of things, like Bob was saying, like topographical maps. When I first started, I was able to actually use modern topographical maps to give me an idea of where exactly did the railroad run. And later on, thanks to web resources, I was actually able to find older versions of those maps that, as I got closer and closer to my own era in the 1890s, I actually managed to find, like Bob is talking about, basically footprints and names of industries that were actually along the line, which was huge in terms of being able to, you know, help figure out what was where. Because when I first started designing my railroad, really all I had was Wilson Point, which was the Real Marine Interface, where the car floats and the ferries came in. I had a yard there. I had another yard at Dockyard, and I had Danbury. And those are the only places I really knew anything about. And so everything else up to that point, I had planned to make room for them and that there would be room to put in industries and sidings. But when I actually started, I had no idea what that stuff was going to be. And those maps, including the Sanborn maps, which were actually hugely helpful for some of the towns that I did. A lot of that information came from those types of maps. So, yeah, Bob's right. Those are great resources, especially if you're looking for eras before the 1970s. There's a lot of different things out there now, different availability of different eras on these maps. You just got to look around and ask around. People have this stuff, and it's very useful.
That's great to know. And even historical societies.
Sure.
I know for me, one thing that was helpful was, of course, Tom Jacobs' website, The Reading Modeler. For me, that was, it made it so easy. It was almost felt like cheating, but because they had the 1954 Reading Freight Car Shipper Guide. So I was able to tell what industry was in every town and what was being delivered there. So,
wow, that's nice.
Yeah, that was huge. So, well, Bob, where to next then?
Well, it's sort of like painting, isn't it? We spent all our time on the preparation, but
yes.
it really does set you up for being able to design a satisfying railroad. And I think, you know, now if we're at a place where we've got the space and we've got a good drawing of it and done the research, we've got our materials, we've set some standards and how far we're going to let that go, it's then how do we look at that and start to develop a plan? And I sort of go at it both micro and macro at the same time, because different spaces will tend to generate different sorts of main lines, and it's possible to, you know, put a certain main line into an area that may be the maximum length of main line that will go in that space. But then you also have to have a sense of what are the pieces, the scenic, signature scenes and features that you want to have, because mm-hmm. you've got to leave enough space for those as well. So, again, having done this preparation and saying, you know, I want to model this yard and I want to model this Y and this industry, and yet I've got this space that's 18 by 22 feet and has a door here and like that, you could start trading those things off and be able to see where you're going from there. But I do have a few tricks about the way I approach the empty space. And the first one I sort of referred to is designing the aisles. And what I mean by that is, you know, you would think the logical place to start would be with the track, but in many cases I'll sort of start with a rectangle that's the width of my desired aisle, say 4 feet to start, and however long, and start placing those around the room and seeing what kind of aisle shapes I can come up with, because if you don't have that planned in, you're not going to have a good walk-in pike. So I spend as much time looking at the spaces where railroad isn't going to go as where it is.
That's excellent advice.
I have found that that's very useful. And then my second trick is sort of a thing I've come up with, which is a set of concentric circles. And if I can sort of describe this, you imagine that you take your minimum radius, let's just say it's 30 inches in HO. Okay. And then maybe you've got a double track, you want to do a double track main line, so you add a couple inches to that, and there's a concentric circle at 32 inches. And then you imagine, like, you want to have a decent space between the outside track and an aisle, so add, say, 3 inches to that, and you're at 35 inches. Okay. And then say you're okay aisle width, minimum aisle width is, say, 24 inches. You add 2 feet to that, and you're up to, where's my math? 35 plus 24 is 59, right? And then beyond that, we might have circles that are even bigger to represent the next piece of outside track and the next piece of inside track and the center of a circle over so it's, we've got this whole series of circles, and in a computer program you can move that whole mess around that, and you can duplicate it to see where the blob that is formed by this circle of track and an aisle and the next blob over are going to fit in relative to the space of the room. And it very quickly shows you, you know, how many turn back curves you're going to be able to fit in any particular space, and combine that with the aisles that you've designed in the first place. It gives you a pretty quick idea of what's going to work in terms of an overall pike shape. I hope that was clear.
Yeah. No,
oh,
I
yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And again, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I think that would have been helpful for me to know early on.
Yeah. I tell you, something else I agree with Bob on that is that starting with the track in a lot of ways is a trap, because it does put you in a mindset not to think about what he's talking about. And as he's saying, for, you know, human tolerances, being able to move around, it's really important to kind of look at it the way he's talking about. We design those areas in first and then work around that. Otherwise, you can end up with an area that's, you know, a layout that's very difficult to get around in, that's not comfortable for people to come over and see, you know. So I totally agree with what Bob's talking about here.
That's great.
Well, I was going to mention one other thing, which is the spiral principle, and that is that if you presume that you want a pike that's got a walk-in aisle, creating sort of a spiral of benchwork and aisleway is going to provide you with a pike shape that requires the least amount of curvature. And most model railroads have way too many curves. Most prototype railroads have a lot more straight track than curved track. Unless you're modeling, you know, a mountain crossing or something like that, mm-hmm. Real railroads tend to go in straight lines unless they have to make a curve. And so, and on the other hand, we're trying to fit a main line into a basement, so we've got to turn around at some point. And if you sort of imagine that the spiral going from the outside of the room around and then narrowing in and narrowing in and then coming back out again on either side of an aisle is going to wind up with a lesser number of degrees of curvature required to get the same amount of main line in there, as opposed to one that has a lobe here and a lobe there coming out. So again, for the average railroad that's representing a railroad that is largely straight, a spiral shape is going to be better than any other approach.
Yeah, spirals also happen to have a good, which for operating railroads, they're also really good because they tend to keep the areas where people are going to be standing well separated, so mm-hmm. that you don't necessarily see easily what's going on the other side of where you are. It's difficult to decide, you know, well, let's see, I don't know if I'm going around the corner, if there's going to be another train there or not. You know, do I want to, you know, try to just run it out, or, you know, try to beat the clock, or should I stay here and wait for the train and I know will eventually be coming? So, you know, not being able to see too far ahead, it can really right. play into your hands well as a designer for an operating railroad. And spirals are great for that.
And I think I got that too. I was gonna say that's one thing. I think the way I designed it is it'll you know. But then again, I have a double track main line, so I'm.
Yeah, that kind of throws that all out the window. But moving right along.
So, you know, as a heading here, how do you evaluate the shapes that result then?
Well, I think you know, it's a hobby and it's your railroad and sure. you can do whatever you want. There are some things that I certainly believe make for a better and more satisfying and more reliable railroad. First off, and you know, shouldn't take this stuff for granted for people who haven't spent a lot of time thinking and reading about railroad planning, is that a walk-in pike is better than one that has lots of duck unders. And the old model of track planning was you basically had a rectangle and you had some gopher holes where you pop up and operate your railroad. And the older you get, the less fun that gets to be.
Right.
And so, and nor does it give you a sense of sort of traveling along with your train. So wherever possible, we try to create an unblocked aisle that you can walk along with the train from town to town as you go. We've already talked a little bit about aisleways and the principle being more access is better than less access. The more access you have, the happier you're going to be. And anything that's inaccessible sooner or later is bound to go wrong, by Murphy's Law. Walk around, is better than having to double back. In other words, to the extent possible, it's good that you, as you're following a train, which in theory is going from one prototype town to another prototype town, you want to follow that in one consistent direction, so you have a sense that you are going somewhere rather than doubling back or retracing your steps. And in the same sort of sense, a railroad where the main line passes through a scene only one time is preferable to one where it comes back through again, because again, that would make no sense in the prototype. theoretically, you're many miles down the line. Why are you all of a sudden going right by the barn again? So we try to keep that separate. And the other thing, you know, in general, I'm trying to get the main line to be as long as possible for the given space. That's, again, we all know that prototype railroads comparison to model railroads are much, much longer. This, you know, mile in NHO is 60 some odd feet.
Right?
Yeah. And so even a short line won't fit in the average basement. So in general, it's good to have the longest main line you can get. Now, that has some asterisks. If you're really into switching and you like doing, you know, lots of switching in a small area, and you're really into having a lot of different industries and like that, you might not care that much about your main line. And if we all fall prey to the temptation to design something that's really too big for us to maintain and build, so squeezing every potential foot of main line is not always what you want to do. And in fact, I could probably fit a much longer main line into my own basement, but I had some realistic sense of how much I could build and what I was trying to accomplish there. So it's really a fairly generous main line for the space that I have. And we talked, I think, a little bit about this in the last show, is that in general, it's good to have a sense of east and west, and to keep that consistent. So that, and the optimum for most of us in North America is that east is to the right and west is to the left, wherever you are. And again, it just sort of subconsciously gives you a sense of where you're going and eliminates a certain amount of confusion. If, you know, you have operators that aren't familiar with your railroad and you say you got to take this eastbound, you know which way out of the yard you want to go, which is not always obvious. And if you can't do east is right and west is left, at least do one where it's consistent so that you're always going in the same direction. Some railroads go mostly north and south. That's fine. And I think even flipping it is okay if you're consistent about it. But it certainly is best if it can be something you can count on.
To say, that's one of the things that I run into an awful lot when I talk to people about design, is that a lot of people just, I'm going to run up all the way to room and then through the helix, and then it's going to come back and go back the other way from the way it came. I'm like, you know, that violates the, you know, consistency in terms of direction. And they're like, oh yeah, but you know, I'm like, no. In fact, I think, didn't we have this with you, Tim, when you first designed?
Well, I didn't realize it, but you were like, you know, that's going to double back. And you're like, but one thing you pointed out was, because, when the helix makes its final turn, it's actually, some 60 inches in the air, so it's okay to have a nod under at that point. So I only, not only did I only need one helix, but I could also keep the layout running in the same direction, which, and the PRSL, Bob, by the way, it, at least it, this division, the Millville line, was a north-south line. So,
I run into that all the time, you know, and you try to convince people, you know, as much as you can that, you know, that's, I mean, like you said earlier, it's your railroad, do what you want, but, you know, it just makes so much more sense to have consistency in terms of direction. And it's not that hard to do. It's definitely worth, you know, going an extra mile and making a change to your plan if you need to in order to keep that. That is such a key and important thing.
Well, I violated that in one of the plans that Model Railroader published this fall, which is based on the Cascade and CDCS. It's escaping me right now what it stands for, but it got some... You know, had a lot of people say they liked the plan. If you look at it, because of the way the helix worked, trains indeed did come out at the top going the opposite direction. But I located that at a place where the prototype literally turns from east-west to north-south.
So that works.
It's been following one river. It's been following the Columbia River at one point, and then it turns up and follows another river that heads up north into Washington State, and so I got away with it that way. But in general,
I saved, Bob. I saved.
Yeah, I was kind of pleased with myself, actually.
Of course, we all know Ralph de Blasio. Now, of course, with his design following one of the curviest rivers known to man, Again, that's also a good excuse to, you know, to have some good curves, have it turn back on itself, because it legitimately does that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of the stuff Bob talked about in the last 5-10 minutes, all these different things, some of these things are such deep concepts that we could actually do an entire show on each one of them.
Yes.
I mean,
that's true.
You know, things like whether walk around is better than double track, or whether, you know, the idea of scenically sincere being better than loops, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that, you know, obviously we're not going to get into that tonight, but right. These are subjects that actually go in terms of layout design really deep. And there's people on both sides of it that will argue until the wee hours of the morning in the bar, you know, about these things. But, you know, I, as a general rule, I think that most of what Bob said, if not all of it, was pretty much spot on. But, you know, you'll go a lot of places and you'll find people who don't agree with that.
Well,
and it makes for some interesting discussions.
And, you know, and I think, too, you know, it's a sidebar, if I may approach the bench, Your Honors, is that, too, it comes down to what is the purpose of your model railroad. Now, if you're into just the modeling aspect of it, knock yourself out. But if you're into the operations, that implies that you care about how a railroad is done. And that's when I think some of these things, like what Bob's talking about, becomes more of a non-negotiable. And well, I mean, again, do what you want. But if you want to do the railroad like it is, well, that's when there's going to be some rigidity that you're going to run into. Correct, Bob?
I think that's right. And you know, rules are made to be broken. I think there's plenty of reasons where you might want to purposefully violate one of these or another. But what is, you know, knowing that these things are good principles for good design, even if you don't think you're into operations, even if you don't think you're into modeling a particular prototype, better to design a railroad that has some of these things built in than to get 8 or 10 years down the road and say, darn, I, you know, my railroad looks beautiful, but I've suddenly decided I really like operations and there's nothing to do. All I can do is go around in circles.
And I have to say, it's so funny you mention that, because there's been so many times, and Craig, I am sure you've seen this too. I know you have, where you see an article in wherever it may be, and this guy has made a beautiful model-wise model railroad, but it's an essentially kind of an old spaghetti bowl design. It folds back on itself, and you see the guy end the article with, and I'm really kind of now looking forward to getting into operations. I think I'd like to start operations. And you look at it, you're like, oh man,
Well, I mean, we've talked about it before, but the most famous example of that is the Franklin and South Manchester.
Yeah, George Selye.
Because George Selye has built that entire railroad, you know, and basically just built it as a photo prop. You were looking at it for all those absolutely gorgeous pictures. Yeah. And as you're saying, Tim, about sometime around, I don't know, eight or nine years ago, I think, he finally got religion and decided he wanted to run the railroad and try to operate it. And he literally had to go back and replace a whole lot of track and change some things around, because it literally couldn't run a train on it.
Right.
It would look beautiful, but it didn't operate worth a damn.
Oh man.
And the other thing is, you know, that people don't need to be too afraid of things. My last evaluation point was to ask yourself where the signature scenes go. And mm-hmm. And you know, we talked a little bit about, if you have particular features you want to model, you want to think about where they're going to be in relation to things like the entrance to the room. And there's no better example for that than a friend of all of ours, Marty McGurk, who built a double deck railroad, and it was a nice design, but he realized that when you came down his basement stairs, the first thing you got to look at was the side of a helix, and that bothered him so much that he ripped the whole second deck off the railroad. And now has rebuilt it as a single level railroad, which is beautiful and gorgeous. And I'm working with him.
He'll probably be coming down in a year or two.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Marty tends to do that. So
he says he's done. He says he's done with the.
He says that every time.
But the point being that if you're going to build that fantastic bridge, you might want to put it out in a place where people are going to see it right when they walk in, or you know, at least when they're operating. So where those scenes can go is another way to look at the shape that you come up with.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, just using my own railroad as an example, Tim's seen this, and anybody who's come down, one of the first things when you walk down the stairs at my place is you come in and make the turn to the left, and you're presented with the large pier scene at Wilson Point, which is just, you know, I mean, okay, I'm so kind of slapping my own back here, but it's a pretty nice scene, you know, and I'm very happy that it is the signature scene of the railroad, and it's the first thing that you see when you come in. And it's funny, it almost didn't happen that way, but I'm really happy that it did work.
It's very effective, Craig. It is very effective.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, guys, you know, because once wasn't enough, and I had to get Tom Jacobs on, and I wish I could say that it was not due to incompetence at all on my part, but the fact is that apparently at some point my old recording bit the dust, and so I had to bring him back on because you guys missed a good amount of footage there. And so, Tom, welcome back to the Model Railcast Show.
Oh, thanks, Tim. I guess I'm like MTV. Too much is never enough.
That's right. Now, Tom, just as a quick side note, did you make it to the the New Jersey RPM? That was
no. You know what? I did not. Unfortunately, we had a wedding in the family, so I was not able to attend. But I heard actually earlier today. I heard that Rob was there and presented on his writing layout. So, you know, he and I are both working with, well, I guess Rob's plan's basically done, but,
right.
You know, he and I have both worked with Bob Sprague to get our layouts designed. So, yeah, I heard he had a good presentation, and I'm sorry to have missed it.
Oh, well, that's, well, you know, at least a wedding, you know, that's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one. Yeah, we, you know, and as you brought up in the pre-show, yes, we were, you know, still getting into the baby routine here. So, yeah, I wasn't able to make it, but that's okay. So for those who don't know, again, just you are modeling the Reading Railroad. What era are you modeling?
I am modeling specifically October 1970 on the Reading's cross line between Rutherford and Allentown.
Okay, excellent. And since we talked to you last, has any work proceeded on your layout?
Yeah. I've been continuing to, you know, get closer to finalizing the layout design and track plan with Bob. And I've actually started construction. Those of you that remember the earlier show, the design that I have calls for a raised floor. It's basically a mushroom-like design. So I've got a raised floor going around the perimeter of the building. So that's basically about two-thirds complete. And then I've started putting together the uprights for benchwork around the walls. So I've been, you know, I've slowly but surely, you know, starting to do some actual construction. Unfortunately, this time of year from September through December is the busiest time of the year at my job, so I haven't had a whole lot of free time. I've been traveling a bit, you know, working, you know, some late hours and things like that. So really haven't had the opportunity to get out in the building and do a whole lot of construction. But hopefully in the next couple of weeks, now that things are kind of winding down at work a little bit, you know, I want to get out there on a more regular basis and get the benchwork going. My goal, and this is probably a bit of a stretch, but I'd like to have the floor finished and be, you know, into benchwork by the end of the year. I'd like to be laying track by January.
Ah, fantastic. That's a good goal.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, when we talked last, there were a few topics that a few things we were going to touch on, and for your model railroad, and as you are modeling a very specific date, I'm guessing this is part of what necessitated what we had started to talk about the last time. And that is what should we touch on first, the custom decal or the custom run of hoppers?
Sure, we can talk about the decals first.
Yeah, let's do that then.
Well, you know, the decals actually grew out of a need that I had for some small little details that were quintessentially Reading. And that's the Reading had some very unique and distinctive cast iron wayside signs that, you know, they cast in their foundry and then, you know, put up along the right of way. Things like, you know, the round oval whistle posts with, you know, the big W in the middle, varieties of no trespassing signs, close clearance signs, speed limit signs, things like that. The Reading had a very unique design. And actually the designs were shared with the Jersey Central, you know, from the time that, you know, the Reading owned the Jersey Central and vice versa and all that stuff. So the Reading and the CNJ actually shared these same same designs. So, you know, these it's a small detail, but it's something that makes a layout uniquely Reading. So it wasn't something that was commercially available. So I figured, well, I'm going to make it myself. So I was able to acquire a copy of the Anthracite Railroad Historical Society many years ago, had put out a book called Standard Plans of the Reading Company. And these were basically a whole bunch of different plans from the Reading Company. And in there were lettering diagrams and measurements for all of these different cast iron right-of-way signs. So between that and some scans that a friend of mine, John Caples, who's another Reading modeler out in Missouri, using Corel Draw, I was able to create artwork files for these wayside signs and sent the artwork file off to Rail Graphics and had decals made to, you know, basically print the you put the decal on a piece of styrene, cut it out, and, you know, mount it with a piece of styrene rod. Put it on your layout. So I made these and I made them in quantities. I figured, well, I'll take what I need for my layout and the rest I'll offer for sale through the website. So that was the first decal set that I had, you know, custom produced. And from there, I started getting requests from people. Well, can you do a set for flat cars? So, okay. I was able to, there's a gentleman, John Hall, who is a Reading modeler and a very knowledgeable Reading historian. He actually had produced several sets of Reading decals in S-scale because he was an S-scale modeler.
Okay.
So he actually shared some of his lettering diagrams and prototype materials and everything with me. So using some of his stuff as a baseline, I then got into, doing decals for Reading Rolling Stock. So at present, I offer sets for flat cars, sets for gondolas, and 4 different types of Reading boxcars, all in HO scale. And, you know, again, these were made because I had a need for them for my own modeling. Other people had a need for them, and I thought, well, you know, I'll make these and put them out for sale.
Oh, excellent. You're doing the model railroad and commuting a service there, I tell you. But yeah. It actually is, though. I mean, because, I think as the hobby is growing and, and I feel like I'm hearing more and more people even modeling the Reading specifically in a lot of Northeastern railroads. So a lot of this stuff just makes it that much more accessible.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, a lot more stuff is coming out, you know, already painted and lettered for Reading. I mean, Athern in particular has put out a lot of Reading stuff lately. Bowser's always good for Reading stuff. You know, and Microscale has been coming out with decal sets for the Reading, which is great. You know, the more the merrier. The one thing that's unique about my sets is if you were a dyed-in-the-wool prototype modeler and you're looking to model different classes of Reading rolling stock, you know, whether it's a particular class of gondola or a particular type of boxcar, what I've done is I've provided sufficient variations in the data, like the capacity data, the dimensional data, even the build dates, so that, you know, if you want to model a particular boxcar, like an XMC class boxcar in speed lettering that was built in 1956, the sets I've done do that. So, you know, not to to knock any of the other manufacturers out there or anything like that. Mine are just a little bit more focused on being able to accurately model a variety of classes of rolling stock for the people that want that type of variety, you know, on their layouts.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. Well, that's really cool. And, if people are interested, how should they contact you?
Well, it's very easy. They can just go to the website, which is readingmodeler.com. Mm-hmm. And there is a link on the homepage to the company store. There's, you know, and from there you can, you know, you can pick, any decal that you're interested in. One of the things I've done there is I've also put links to a picture of the actual artwork and then also a photo of an actual car lettered in that particular decal set.
Ah. Okay.
So you can essentially see what you're getting.
Right.
And what I've done, is each set gives you enough material to actually model two cars.
Nice. That's really huge.
And, and they are, you know, I mean, I feel they're very good. You know, most sets are $6. So, you know, doing two cars for $6, I think that's a pretty good value.
Yeah.
You know, I'm certainly not, you know, my goal here was not to make a ton of money or get rich or anything like that. It's really basically just to cover my costs of manufacturing them.
Right.
And if nothing else, it, you know, any proceeds I make go right back into keeping the website up and running or getting material to develop the next set of decals. You know, I have a couple other projects in the work that I'm hoping before too long to put out, things like covered hoppers. There's a couple more boxcar sets that I'd like to do. I'd even like to do an open, you know, a regular coal hopper set at some point. So,
nice. Oh, nice. Well, and speaking of hopper sets, you had to do one, didn't you?
Wow, what a great segue. I didn't even plan that. Yeah, actually I did. They're on the layout that or the design that we've put together, there is a stretch of the main line coming out of Reading, the original main line that would go between you know, Philadelphia to Pottsville through Reading. And off of the main line, off of the Wilmington and Northern branch, Grace Mine, that was owned by Bethlehem Steel, had a very large iron mine called the Grace Mine. And there was a train, you know, basically called the Grace Miner, that ran every day between the mine down. It was actually called the Joanna Turn, I'm sorry. Ran between the mine and Bethlehem Steel. So basically what would happen would be there would be a train of empties at Reading that would leave Reading in the morning. They would go down the main line, down to the WN branch, down to the mine. They would load up with iron ore, come back to Reading. Train would cool its heels for a while in Reading Yard and head up to Bethlehem in the evening. At the same time, a train of empties would come down around 8-9 o'clock at night from Bethlehem to Reading, and that would be the empties for the next morning's train. So it just was basically like a big loads in, empties out type of operation. So this, you know, this is a very interest. I found this was a very interesting train on the layout. So I'm, you know, since I have this little stretch of main line and I model the East Penn branch between Reading and Allentown, and essentially Bethlehem is staging, I was able to model this train. Now, what was unique is that the Reading ordered a couple classes of 100-ton hoppers in the era that I'm modeling that were dedicated to this service, this iron ore service.
Okay.
So, you know, rather than try and round up all of these cars on eBay or whatever, I contacted Bowser and inquired about doing a custom run of hoppers. So, you know, they gave me the artwork for the car itself, and I did the bare bones of the data, that would go on the side of the car, namely the Reading speed lettering, the capacity, the dimensional data, things like that. And I had a custom run of these cars produced. And along with that, since I'd already been doing decal sets, rather than just have a set of like four or five numbers, I figured I was going to need basically shooting for two trains of 25 cars each. And the way the staging is, it's basically they're going to cycle out a loaded train and an empty train. And so I needed 50 cars, 50 car numbers. So basically what I did was I basically left the numbers blank and included a decal set with the numbers. There was also some other little unique pieces of lettering that went on some of these cars. For example, some of them were leased from the Western Maryland, so there was a truss stencil that had to go on the car, things like that. So what I the minimum run from Bowser was 200 cars. I needed 50 cars for myself, so I did a run of 200, and the other 150 I made available through the website. And they sold out in a matter of weeks.
Wow. Nicely done.
Yeah, and here again, it really just, you know, again, I believe me, I am not getting rich off of this stuff. It's really just, you know, the goal was to cover my cost. And, you know, I made these available, you know, if I remember right, I sold them for whatever the going rate for at the MSRP was for a regular Bowser car. So,
right.
You know, it was certainly reasonable. And again, you could do any car number that you wanted with the decal artwork that I provided with the car.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. And so, so where are you storing all yours though? I'm guessing you must have a tremendous closet.
Well, everything's actually out in the barn.
Okay.
As I've started building this raised floor for the layout, which is actually, you know, 30 inches off of the building floor, the way that I've constructed that floor system, I have a lot of underfloor storage space. So most of my stuff is in the big, you know, the big Rubbermaid storage tubs, and everything is pretty much just shoved under that raised floor for the time being. Until I can, you know, until I have need of it. I mean, these things, I haven't even tried putting any of them together yet. They're in their original boxes.
Okay.
You know, the one thing, they did come with plastic wheels, so I've got to get metal wheels for all of them and put them all together and put the decals on. So, you know, that's going to be a project in itself one day.
Yeah.
But, yeah, everything's in storage except for my tools these days, because I'm, you know, basically I'm focusing on is trying to get the floor built and then move on to bench work. So all the locomotives and cars and structure kits are all packed away.
Gotcha. And well, and here's another segue. Unless you had anything more you wanted to cover on those hoppers, but you did mention tools, and I know you also wanted to talk about some 3D printing with us.
Yeah, that's another thing that I've started to play with. You know, I saw something on the internet a couple of years ago about 3D printing, and I was just, you know, blown away. And you know, I got it in my mind that I had to have a 3D printer. Well, when I called the company and they told me one cost $20,000, that quickly shot that down.
Yeah.
But you know, there's what I've actually been able to do, and it comes down to a couple more little unique items to make a layout uniquely Reading. Been able to use Shapeways, you know, the company where you create the 3D artwork.
Mm-hmm.
You email it to them or you upload it to them through their website, and they will make a 3D print of your model, and you basically pay by the volume of material. So another item that I've made available through the website is something unique that the Reading had. At every mile along the right-of-way, they had these little concrete rail racks. They're basically just a little concrete shelf. They came in pairs, and they stuck these in the ground at every mile, and they held two 39-foot lengths of rail. And that way, you know, if a rail broke or something happened, the section gang would have, you know, a source of at least a couple pieces of rail at various points if they had to come in and do any repairs. So the blueprint for these rail racks was in that plan book that I mentioned a couple minutes ago. So it was a fairly easy matter to, you know, create that in Google SketchUp, which is a free 3D modeling program that you can download off the web and create the file in HO scale and send it off to Shapeways and have those printed up. So here again, you know, creating something that, you know, I need for my own layout, and then I'm also able to offer those for sale. And basically with those, I offer it that you get a pair of these little rail rack castings, and then I provide two lengths of rail, you know, cut basically from microengineering rail. And you basically have a little complete kit. You basically just have to paint them up any concrete color of your choosing, paint the rail, stick these things in the scenery, and you're good to go.
Nice. That's awesome.
So the 3D printing, you know, is really, you know, I really think it's going to revolutionize the hobby. I mean, I think, and quite frankly, it already is.
Oh, definitely.
If you listen to the Scotty Mason podcast, you know, Jimmy Simmons has branched out from laser cutting into 3D printing for some of the projects that he's working on. Also, Bowser just got into the 3D printing game for some of their detail parts. I noticed on their website a couple weeks ago that some of the detail parts they're offering in their kits and stuff are now 3D printed. Yeah.
And so they're catching on, man.
Yeah, and if you go on the Shapeways website and search on, you know, model trains or model railroad, people are doing all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, anything from detail parts like you know, little picnic tables or little mailboxes or whatever, all the way up to, you know, locomotive bodies, and there's a guy actually, since we're talking about the Reading here, somebody's actually done a 3D model of a Reading Blue Liner MU car.
Oh, wow.
You know, and some of the parts and everything that go with that. So, you know, that's something that's kind of hard to come by. You know, they really, unless you're looking for a brass set. But so there's this, if you can draw it and get it into the computer as a 3D model, you can, you know, you can have that object. It's almost like the replicator from Star Trek. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And what's even better is actually, you know, the cost of 3D printers themselves has come way down. You know, you can get, if you're, mechanically inclined and are willing to invest the time to assemble one and put the components together, you can get one for under $1,000. And there's some ready-made, basically ready-to-run versions of 3D printers that aren't much more than $1,000. In fact, I saw one, Home Depot is now selling one. Dremel is making a 3D printer. Yeah, it was on their website not too long ago. So, you know, I really think this is basically where scratch building is going to go
right
in the next couple of years. I mean, basically, if you've got the vision and you kind of know what you want, you can draw it on the computer, but maybe you don't have the fine motor skills to cut the styrene and do all that. Then
I'm waving, you know, my hand madly here.
Yeah. Well, me too. So I really, I've been playing with some other ideas, drawing up some things like some building sides and things like that for some small little like maintenance away sheds and things like that. Not necessarily to offer that whole thing as a 3D printed kit, but another avenue is if you print something like that, it has a pretty good level of detail that you can then use as a master and make a mold and then cast it in resin.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of a means to an end in terms of, you know, pattern making and things like that.
Yeah, very cool.
So that's kind of what I've been playing with. You know, again, nothing really ready for prime time, but, you know, just, again, trying to make sure that I can get what I feel that I need for the layout to be an accurate representation of some key Reading scenes, like, you know, for example, the yard office in Spring Street at Reading Yard, or the tower at Lebanon Valley Junction. You know, those are like some key elements that really need to be accurate in order for the layout to really deliver on what I wanted to deliver on from a realistic standpoint. So, you know, I'm going to obviously have to scratch build that stuff. So it's either going to be, I'm going to have to try my hand at scratch building, or if I can do this a little bit more easily with 3D printing, then that's an avenue that's available.
Well, that's great. Well, Tom, thank you for coming back on. So,
oh, my pleasure.
And we'll definitely be keeping in touch with you in the future. I want to check in with you by the end of the year or beginning of next year, just to see where you're coming, how your layout's coming along. But once again, the name of your website.
Sure, it's the Reading Modeler, and that's Reading, R-E-A-D-I-N-G, modeler.com. We've got, I mentioned the company store. There's a very active forum. There's a number of folks out there modeling the Reading that are very active and sharing ideas, sharing photographs, both prototype as well as models that they've built. I've got a pretty broad reference section for things like the freight schedule. I've got some timetables, rule books, a number of different modeling articles and things like that. So there's a fair amount of material there for people that are interested in the Reading or just, you know, prototypical operation type stuff.
Great. That's fantastic. All right. Thanks so much, Tom.
Anytime, Tim. Thank you.
Yes, signature scenes. I mean, for me, it's not the first thing that you see, but for me, one of the important things was the old New York shipbuilding industry, which is there. And I definitely get trying to make sure that you're working that in as part of the design. After we talk signature scenes, what's hardest to fit in, and how in the heck do you plan for it?
Yeah, that's a big one. And I think one of the trickiest ones can be staging. Again, it's something that you always wish you had more than you think you needed in the first place. Oh, yeah. And yet, going back to how we talked about train length, if you have a modern railroad and you're trying to run 25-car trains, say, with three locomotives and a caboose or no caboose or something like that, you've got to have tracks in your staging that are that long, which can be 25, 28, 30 feet. That's a lot of space, even when it's bent around a curve or something like that. So fitting staging in is tricky, especially if you want to have it double-ended so that you can, have a return loop to stage a train back in the direction it came.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say also you really have to plan it from the beginning, because if you don't, you're not going to find a place to put it when you're all done.
That's for sure. And again, if you have it, as most of us want to, on both ends of your main line, so you can represent connections to the east and to the west or north and south or whatever direction you're going, it can be even trickier to find that space to do that. So that and some of the most effective, if you've got the space to do it, is to create a mole type arrangement, which is the word for almost a separate little room where the staging is in there, and you can slip in there and fiddle cars on and off and get to the tracks. But again, that can use up a fair amount of space if your space is limited. And a second challenge is yards themselves. If you want a functioning yard, and if you're following the Tint Craig's commandments, as we all do now, you need to have not only body tracks in the yard that are long enough to handle the trains you want to have, but a good yard lead, a drill track that extends out. So if you've got that 25-foot space you need for a modern train, then you need almost that much space past the ladder for your drill track so that you can deal with long cuts of cars. And now all of a sudden you're talking about a yard that can be 40 or 50 feet long, and very few of us have a straight wall that will accommodate a yard like that.
That is true.
We wind up bending them around corners in many cases. So again, it's just a tricky thing to fit in if you want to have a good functioning yard.
You also mentioned that's something we don't often think about.
Yeah, they're a neat prototype feature, the problem with Y's is that they're three-dimensional and we're two-dimensional in a lot of our planning. The Y's meaning if you want to have access to all three turnouts, especially in HO or bigger, there's going to be a lot of depth there, and you've got to figure out a way to work it in so that you can get to all three turnouts. So if you want to have a Y, and they can be really signature scenes in a plan, often it's good to station them in a blob type arrangement where it's up above a turn back curve, and you can somehow get to the third turnout, the one that's away from the wall, by popping up in an access hatch or even reaching in from from another aisle. The plan I did recently that had the Porter Seidling Y, you actually get to the third turnout by coming in from the other side of the benchwork past a floor-to-ceiling backdrop, so it's quite accessible and runs out to a branch line in that direction, so it doesn't allow you to directly walk to the branch line, but it provides good access to the Y.
And something that I feel, well, actually, Y's, there's a Y in Woodbury, so I will have to figure out how exactly I'm going to deal with that, and I may just make a representation of that. But one thing that I do have to take into account is going to be, One thing I'm going to have to take into account is factoring in a helix. And Bob, they're always bigger than we think they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's just a concentric circle. And again, you don't want to cheat the radius. You don't want to get it too small. One, so that you are sure you can operate your biggest equipment on it. And two, because the tighter it is, the steeper the grade you need to make it work. So there's not much point in having, nice moderate 1.5% grades everywhere else in the railroad, and then all of a sudden you get into a Y that's 24 inches in radius, and you've got to have 4% to get up to the next level.
Yeah, that's bad.
But even a 24-inch Y, by the time you, or sorry, a 24-inch radius helix in HO, that's 48 inches plus space on either side that it's got to be allowed for in a complete circle, so you're really talking about a lot of real estate there to fit in a Y anywhere else. Has to be.
It's true. And I tell you, helixes, anybody who's listening to the show for a while knows that helixes are not among my favorite things. I understand, and I've been to many railroads where it's a necessary thing. And, it allows you to do certain things that wouldn't be at all possible in any other way sometimes. But I think everybody, if you have a decent space, I mean, if you're dealing with a small bedroom, then obviously that's probably going to be one of your only options if you want to go to more than one level. But if you have a larger space, I wish a lot of people would consider doing an unwound helix, where you have a lower level. And then as you leave the lower level, you start going up around the wall or around the room and, gain 1.5-2% all the way around until you get to another level higher up, and that to me is a much more effective use of the space because the way that things go, because I just hate when you get in a helix and your train disappears for 5 minutes and you can't see it. You can't hear it. You don't know what's happening. It's, it could have stopped in there like right after it went inside and you wouldn't know it. Helixes make me crazy.
I certainly don't go there if I have any choice to fit in.
Needs
to be fit in. Yeah,
I see so many people a lot of times when they're doing a plan, though, immediately plan one in without even considering that there might be another way to do this. Even if it's to instead of having a 4-5 turn helix, maybe if you had a 2-3 turn and use some of the space that you have to kind of go up about 3-5 inches before you hit that helix.
Yep.
I see people just run into it, and then there's a helix as tall as an oil can, and it's just you didn't have to do that.
Yeah, and that's why one of the things that as I plan on doing, raising the elevation of the track before it even gets to the helix on mine. Now, Bob, one thing I will ask you, and I didn't see it here, but when you have to make a helix, I've seen some people in these designs, fit in a helix that or even some people have advertised, hey, we sell a 22 radius helix. That doesn't even sound, the grade on that must be so, what people aren't taking into account is the tighter the radius, the harder your engine's going to have to pull.
Yeah.
So if you had to design Helix, what would you prefer to be the minimum radius?
Oh, I think...
There's so many factors that go into that.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, like your train length.
Well, scale, too. I mean, a 22-inch Helix and the N-scale is not a big deal because you don't need, you know, it doesn't need to be that high, although you do have to allow for plywood depth and roadbed depth. You know, you may still want to put your N-scale trains on 3/4-inch plywood, and so you've got to account for that. But in HO, if you get much tighter than 30 or 28, you're going to have a pretty stiff grade in that Helix. It depends what you're modeling. I mean, if it's a logging railroad and you've got chaise, no problem. But to try to drag a long modern train up a Helix that's much heavier than that. I've got another tool that I'll put on my website, which is a grade estimator, and it's pretty simple. But it allows you to type in a radius, a percentage or a number of degrees, and then how much altitude you're going to gain at any particular percentage of grade, which is very handy. So, you know, if you type in 30 inches and 180 degrees and, you know, 2.5%, it'll tell you how far you're going to go up in that much distance. And that's the kind of calculation you have to make to figure out how steep your Helix has to be to get one track over another.
That sounds like a really good tool, too. Talk to us then real quick about junctions and perpendicular sidings, if you would, Bob.
Well, junctions are great because they, you know, it's been pointed out, they're sort of the universal industry where if you have a junction with another railroad and an interchange track of any kind, you can leave anything there and you can pick up anything there. The problem is, again, that junctions are sort of three-dimensional rather than the linear main line. All of a sudden you've got a track crossing at an angle, and any kind of connecting track that goes from one to the other can rapidly run you out of benchwork, especially if you want it to be a functioning junction where trains can actually run from the connecting railroad onto your railroad or back and forth. And it just tends to, especially in HO or a bigger scale, become something that requires a lot of depth, and then it becomes an access problem. It can be done in a variety of ways, but again, something you need to plan for and work around early. I mean, like we did Norm Wolf's railroad that was based on Doswell Junction, which worked out pretty well because we made the crossing a little tighter than the prototype crossing, and trains would appear out of staging on the RFNP leg and come across, and on the other direction they were going into staging, which represented the CNO tracks, and that worked out pretty well. And Model Railroader published that one this fall as well.
Cool.
And then the perpendicular spur thing is that, at least in the modern era, if you look at real track layouts, often the way a spur will work into any kind of modern factory is that there'll be off the main line a pretty tight curve, and the spur itself will be perpendicular to the main. And it's very effective, and it looks very prototypical when you do it, but here again, it requires a lot of depth. And I've seen people do it out into an aisleway, which can be pretty cool. I think David Barrow had a fairly famous scene where the track bends away from the main and comes perpendicular out into a piece of benchwork that protrudes into the aisle. And as long as your aisle is wide enough, you can work around that. And it's actually pretty good for switching because it makes it very visible. So it's a neat feature, but again, you got to have the aisle width that will allow you to do that.
Yeah, and just to add to that real quick, if anybody's interested in the idea of how to model junctions, probably one of the better railroads out there to kind of study and see how he did it is Tony Custer's Nickel Plate Third Sub Railroad. And because he's got about five or six, maybe as many as seven different junctions on the railroad that he actually does interchange with all the other railroads from the Nickel Plate. And a lot of them are done they're not all done the same. There's some very interesting ideas about the way that he's done a number of things. And if you go back through Model Railroader and some of his Trains of Thought columns, too, over the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, you can find a lot of interesting things on the way that he operates those and the way that they're designed. And it's definitely something that's worth doing if you have the time and the resources, because I think he's come up with some of the more interesting ways of actually making that work. You know, basically having an active interchange at these junctions, and that makes things so much more interesting operationally. So definitely something worth looking
at. Bill Darnaby is another one.
Sure, yeah.
Friend of Tony's with his Maumee route has a lot
absolutely,
of junctions.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, you, Bob, you did address this a bit, but I wasn't sure, was there more you wanted to get into with not getting tripped up by grades?
Well, I think, yeah, in the planning process, it's real easy to draw out all the tracks and everything and all your benchwork and all your aisleways and get all excited about things, and then all of a sudden realize that you've drawn something that's literally impossible. it depends on a terrible grade to do what you've done to cross one thing over another thing. And again, like a lot of other things, grades take a lot of space. The way we measure them, as you guys know, but maybe everybody doesn't, is how many inches rise in 100 are you talking about? So if you rise 1 inch in 100, that's a 1% grade. 2 inches in 100 is 2%, etc. And so you think, again, that 100 inches is 8 1/3 feet. To get even to a 4.5% or 4.5 inches, say, for an HO track to cross over another HO track, which is close to minimum, you're talking about, 20 feet or so to make that distance. And again, there's been many times where, as many of these as I've done, I've designed something and I've got one track going over another track and there's only 4 feet in between them. And I say, that's just not going to work. And, several days of getting excited about a plan go down the, where, cause I've failed to think about the grades there. Yeah. Yeah. That's really a buzzkill. So the trick is mainly to do a grade check pretty early, and in a computer, this is not too hard. You can measure your tangents, of course, and then my grade estimator, again, that I'll put on my website, you can say how many degrees is that curve and what's the radius, and therefore how much of 8 1/3 feet am I accomplishing by going around a curve, and figure out whether you're in a reasonable range.
And another thing I'll just, again, point out that I'm sure that Bob will agree with completely, is that if you are going to plan in a grade on your railroad or helix, it's usually an excellent idea to have the ruling grade, meaning the steepest grade on your railroad, not be in the helix or someplace where you can't get to it. A good idea is always, even if it's not for the full train length, make the steepest grade on your railroad someplace where you can get to it, and preferably right at the beginning, so if you don't make it up there, right, you know already that, okay, now you're going to need help or to break the train or something along the way before you get into trouble in the helix or someplace where you can't reach the train.
Yeah, it's a very good idea, and the other factor about a helix and a grade, of course, is that just like on the real railroad, the curvature adds that much more difficulty to the grade. So a straight grade of 2.5% may be fine, and then all of a sudden you're in helix doing 2.5% and you can't do it because you've got that extra stress of taking the curve.
Yeah. All right, makes sense. What kind of adjustments then and tweaks do you make as you're completing the design?
Once I've got the main line pretty well set and some of these trickier features worked in, what I find is that when I start putting in things like structures and roads and scenic features, things tend to start moving around. And it's like with everything else, structures are bigger than you think they are, even the kind of small ones we tend to use on our railroads. And same with roads, which are very important the interaction between roads and railroads, of course, is very important as well. And, you know, one trick is a lot of times we design our railroads and we've got a single line representing the track. We sort of forget that it's really an HO a couple inches wide, and what looks like a lot of space between just little lines on a piece of paper, you realize once you try to put in a building and a loading platform and a bunch of trees and a background and things like that, there really isn't nearly as much space as you thought there was. And in some cases, you may want to, you know, eliminate tracks or simplify arrangements or slide things right or left or front or back to get the, you know, optimum use of the space and make sure that you can fit in those features that you're really into. And I've got a pretty good library of buildings now. Even if somebody doesn't specify what they want to have, I can throw in real footprints of real kits and buildings to make sure that I'm not making an unrealistically small space for an industry. Another thing that is important to look at when you're done or nearing that is the consistency of your train length, how that impacts staging tracks and yards and passing sidings. It doesn't mean they all have to be bigger than your longest train, because you can get a lot of operating fun out of a siding that's a little too short, and you have to do saw-bys or plan which trains can hit that at what times. But if you really want to be running consistently a train of any particular length, you want to make sure that most of your tracks can accommodate that. And sometimes some are too short and some are too long, and you just can optimize that a little bit. And then you also have to think about construction realities. I know you guys know Tom Jacobs real well, and I've been working with him for some time on his plan. And we got to a point where we were both real happy with the overall shape of the railroad, and then I suddenly scratched my head and said, I don't think there's any way to build this thing. You know, it's kind of floating in midair. We had to dial back a little bit and say, okay, well, we can, you know, build a wall up from the floor here, and then we can actually connect to the ceiling there, because it's sort of a semi-mushroom kind of thing is what we're winding up with. But we had to make some alterations simply to build something that didn't need to be supported by anti-gravity jets or something. So those are the kind of tweaks. And luckily, if you've not been too ambitious at the beginning, it's usually a matter of making adjustments and sliding things around rather than having to significantly scale back. But there is quite a bit of adjustment that can happen toward the end of the process.
Excellent.
And, you know, construction realities, you know, one of the things that I didn't take into account, and it's a very concrete reality, literally, is that my concrete floor isn't perfectly level.
Uh-huh.
So it's not enough to just say, okay, I'm going to keep all the benchwork 41 inches off the ground or 48 or whatever. Because in some areas that may, you know, that may be 47 and three quarters. It may be 48 and a quarter. You know, trying to keep it level as opposed to measuring it directly off of the concrete floor itself.
Yeah, well, there's a great way to work around that, and that is introduce you to my friend the water level.
Yes.
which is a very useful tool that probably not nearly enough people know about or use. And basically the idea behind it is it's just a really long, clear plastic tube that you basically tie to a post or something in your space, and then you fill it with water to a certain level so that when you're holding up the other end of the hose, basically you mark where you want the level to be on the one that's fixed. And then you mark when you pull the hose up and down. And as it does, the water tends to seek its own level within the hose. So then you know that when the water reaches the level that you've marked on the fixed end, you can mark the hose on the other end where the water is. And you know that wherever you go in space, if you get there and you can get the water to be at that same level by getting it to that mark, wherever you go in that space, that is a level line all around your space. And that when I built my railroad, that was the very first thing that we did. We went around the entire room, around all the lolly columns and our projection along the walls, and we used that water level to mark a level line all the way around the space. And let me tell you something, that made a huge difference.
Well, you know, speaking of you know, going all the way back to the beginning where we're talking about measurements, you're not necessarily going to have a square room either.
Oh, that's very true. Sure.
I've had people with older homes, and I said, now, wait a minute. You've given me a measurement on one wall that's 27 feet and 3 inches. And if you add up the dimensions of the other wall, it's 27 feet and 6 inches. And right. they go back down and measure and say, that's what it is. And it's not square at all.
Now it's time to break out a protractor and find out where you don't have a 90-degree corner.
That's right. That's right. It can be very common.
Oh, that's great stuff. Well, Bob, is there any closing thoughts that you'd like to leave us with then as we wrap up here?
Well, no, I think we've covered a heck of a lot of ground, and, you know, I'd encourage people to just have fun with this part of the process. It can be as much fun as a lot of other aspects in the hobby, and, you know, there's a lot of people out there who can give you some good advice about plans before you get too far into building them, and it's a good thing to listen to because, you know, we're all eager to start putting track down and building benchwork and all that stuff, but a little planning can go a long way.
And here's something I will throw your way off script here, Bob, and that is, and I think it's, I'm curious just to get your answer because you are a planner and a designer. What do you do, though, and I'm going to use Will Aris's phrase here, what do you do, though, to prevent analysis paralysis? Because you can go too far with that, yes? Or
yes.
In your mind, can't you?
No, it's absolutely true, I think it's easy to get into analysis paralysis, but it's like any other aspect of the hobby. You just start doing it and you just start experimenting and you don't be too afraid of making mistakes, especially at the, you know, when you've still got time to rip up a piece of paper and do it again or create a new draft in your computer or whatever you're doing. And, it's the more you do it, the better it gets. And sooner or later, you'll come up with a design that, you know, this isn't going to be perfect, but you've road tested it and you've thought about it and you've, you know, maybe laid it out in duct tape on your basement floor and you say, this is going to make a nice railroad and I'm going to go for it.
Right.
And the other thing is, and I think, you know, you look at some of the top names in the hobby, you know, they'll build something and it will be right in line with the excellent plan that they designed and vetted with all their friends, and it still doesn't work, and they'll rip out big sections and do them over because that's just the way it goes sometimes. And it's, you know, hey, the fun's in the building, so you got to build it again.
That's true. And I'll say one other thing is that when people are one thing that Bob mentioned was, you know, looking around for different ideas and things like that. And one thing I would say if you're going to do, especially if you're going to go look at other people's plans, say in Model Railroader or any magazines or even online, by all means, look at them, enjoy them. But approach them with a critical eye. And what I mean by that is instead of just gluing and say, well, that's really cool, this and other thing, really sit down and try to analyze it as if you were going to be running that railroad. Say, you know, like, well, gee, here comes the yard. How would, if I had a train that I had to bring in here and work with somebody who was running the yard as a yardmaster, how would we make this work? How would I, you know, get cars off my train and then, you know, have the switcher pick them up and move them into the yard and that type of thing? Or, you know, does this layout really work? Is the, are the sidings too close together? You know, basically I'm like, if I have a train that'll work, you know, on this, is it going to be rolling over into the next town while I'm trying to work? It's a great idea because you can go through and look at a lot of different ideas, but by approaching it critically, you can see what works and what doesn't specifically for you. And so, you know, by all means do that, but definitely approach it with a critical eye.
Well, you know, you mentioned something that's really important, Craig, and that is seeing other railroads and experiencing other railroads, because I still, every time I visit or operate on a railroad, I always learn something and I'll say, boy, this is a nice way to handle that, or boy, is that really a problem? And I, you know, just designed a railroad that included something like that, and now I wish I hadn't. You can learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work, and what you prefer and what you, you know, don't like in a railroad. And I think that can. I mean, I can think of several railroads that I was lucky enough to operate on that just completely changed my point of view of what I wanted in my own railroad and what I would design in railroads for other people. And in many cases, in a positive way, you know, say, I really liked that. I mean, you know, the whole aisle way, I hadn't really thought, you know, why would you leave 4 feet for an aisle when you could fill it with track and bench work? And then I operated on a couple layouts with 4 feet, and it was comfortable and it was fun. And
it's a pleasure, right?
See what you were doing, and you weren't always bumping into other people and stuff like that. Wow, I'm going to do this whenever I can. And I operated another railroad that was a double layer railroad, and the guy had exactly the right heights for the bench work. It was, you know, it's always a challenge where, what are the heights for the bench work? And this one, he just nailed it. It was just perfect, for me. And then, you know, I figure if the layout owner's 2 inches shorter than me, I should reduce that by 2 inches, in what I suggest for elevations. But getting out there and seeing other railroads and experiencing them and operating on them is great education.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the thing is that that's not always an option for everybody. But by all means, if it is an option, if you know people, and get out there, you know, visit people, see railroads, and like Bob said, find out what you like, find out what you don't like, and apply that to what you're doing. And it'll make you a much happier owner.
That's great advice. Well, Bob, we would love to touch base with you again soon. Actually, I would actually like to talk with you at some point about go back again over some of the layouts that you have designed. And I know you came up with another one for our buddy Norm Wolf, yes, which he's working on now.
Yeah, well, he's got the darn thing almost done.
Yeah, he's tell you what, man.
He's stuck it, which is great. You know, I'll add one other thing in a neat segue, which is that, you know, a great way to learn about railroads is to get together with lots of other talented modelers at an event like the Mid-Atlantic Railroad Modelers Meet.
Please do plug that. Yes, that's coming up, isn't it?
How was that for a segue?
No, that was great.
I loved it.
Yeah, well, you know, and I know Eric Hansman's is coming up again.
Yeah.
But also, too, yes, the Mid-Atlantic one. When is that going to be, Bob?
Well, it's September, and I want to say it's the 24th and 25th. It's a little bit later this year, and I ought to know that by heart, but 25th and 26th, I'm sorry. It's Friday and Saturday. It's in the same location as this year that we and actually, we haven't talked to you since then, but we just felt that it was a really nice event this year. Everybody seemed to have a great time, and it was
a lot of fun.
A much better location that was great for the vendors, and it was great for the clinicians and the people coming, and it was relaxed, and you know, a lot of great information, a lot of great clinicians, and we've got some great clinicians already set up, including some old favorites who have been with us before, and some new folks as well, including Paul Dulcus, who's going to be there this year, and he's always great. And Tom Jacobs is going to do a piece. Dave Myers, who does the Gator Forum, is going to be there. Gator Phone, that is. Matt Thompson, who has a beautiful layout in this area, and Andrew Dodge, and certainly some others that will be returning. And you can take a look. We got preliminary website up at marpm.org, and registration is open for anybody who wants to sign in sooner the better, as far as we're concerned. But we'll be putting up more detail as it comes closer.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, Bob, thanks so much for coming on the program. We look forward to having you on again. I really appreciate you being able to do that.
Well, I appreciate being here. It's a lot of fun.
And your website is?
My own website is AnnapolisJunctionRR.com.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we can find those tools you're talking about.
Yeah, the tools are there. A lot of my plans are there for folks to look at, and even a few pics of what I'm trying to do in the basement.
All right, great. And Craig, thank you. And guys, don't forget Amesville Shops, right?
Yeah, Amesville Shops. By all means, AmesvilleShops.com, AmesvilleShops.com. Check it out. Let's have a look at the new gondola that's just been released, and order 20 of them, you know.
Yes,
or even one. They're actually a lot of fun to build. I'm actually in the process of building one more right now, just to finish up the instructions, and I'm having a real ball with it. It's got some, what I think are some pretty innovative ideas in terms of Craftsman wood car kits, which, you know, I don't think anybody else is doing, frankly. I think if you end up ordering one, you'll really enjoy building it, and it builds up into a really nice car.
So, Craig, was the chassis system still running those in 1986?
Well, of course.
Okay. And I'll order 20 of them.
All right.
Yeah.
Woohoo! Oh, go great. To college. Oh, man. All right, guys. Well, that'll be it for us, and we will look forward to Craig, who's on the list? Who are we recording with next week on the 10th?
Well, let's see. On the March 10th, I think we're scheduled to record with Jonathan Jones, who is an old friend of mine from up this area, and Jonathan is an architect. In professional life, and one of the things that we're going to be talking about with him is the idea of how architecture can be used in modeling,
right,
as a way to try to really make more realistic structures. But not only that, also, you know, in terms of layout design, what can architecture tell us about how things should go together?
Ah, fantastic.
I think it's going to be a really interesting show.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Bob, thanks again, Model Railcasters. We will look forward to seeing you guys again on Show 207.
You've been listening to the Model Railcast Show. Thank you for tuning in. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show, please contact us at 513-327-8765 or email ryan@modelrailcast.com. This is Philippa Ballantyne for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.
We haven't got through point one yet.
You know, we have to do it. You know, if it goes...
I'm on a roll here.
You go ahead. The nice thing is it starts up.
Don't let us stop you.
As soon as I hit the stop button, it actually starts recording the next segment right away, but it lets me see what's going on, too.
Hey, that's good.
Yes. So fire away, Bob. All right, let me just go back and...
Yeah. It's like a squirrel. He just goes and saves it every now and then. It's like
a story
of little nuts.
It is. That's like... It's going to be such a seamless edit, Bob. Nobody will ever
know. No, I know.
Until they listen to the outtakes.
You'll make me sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
Congratulations are in order. You have a new addition.
Yeah, it's the one thing that I'm efficient in, you know?